Right, we've got a whole bunch of philosophy memes to both laugh at and, more importantly, learn from. So, let's get started. My name is Joe Folley, and this is Unsolicited Advice. Next, we have a meme by Linked Punk, and he's called it, "Are there still arguments in favor of determinism?" And it's Tom and Jerry, and there's Tom, labeled determinism, facing off against a little mouse called Free Will Problem, a slightly bigger mouse called Buridan's Paradox, and then an enormous mouse called Quantum Physics. Is quantum physics a good argument against determinism? I think, God, maybe I'm just being a parody of myself here. I think it sort of depends what you mean by determinism. Let's think about Laplace's demon, right? So in Laplace's demon, in that thought experiment, Laplace is asking us to consider whether a demon that knew everything about the past and everything about the present moment would be able to perfectly predict the future. So originally, this idea of determinism didn't just refer to some doctrine about free will. Determinists weren't just people that didn't believe in free will. Determinism proper, I suppose, or full determinism, or whatever you want to call it, is a belief about the world at large, not just about our choices. So if you are a kind of full determinist, you think that literally everything is predetermined, including these quantum events, then yeah, I suppose kind of quantum uncertainty or the inherent stochasticity in quantum physics would undermine that position, at least as far as I understand. I mean, quantum physics is just, I don't know if any of you who aren't physicists have ever tried getting to grips with any of the maths around quantum mechanics. It is really hard. And, you know, I'm a mathematics enthusiast. I wouldn't call myself a great mathematician, but it is just incredibly difficult. And yet, but from what I understand, which is basically nothing, quantum physics would undermine this much fuller idea of determinism, whereby it's not simply about our choices, it's about everything in the world. Is everything in the world determined? If there is some inherent, you know, non-reducible and never will be reducible stochasticity to quantum mechanics, then yes, I suppose that thesis is refuted. I think the danger for me is when people start to say something like, okay, there is this inherent uncertainty to events. There is uncertainty at the base level structure of the universe. Therefore, there is room for free will to wiggle its way in. And I suspect that's, at the very least, going to require much more substantial argumentation. On the face of it, I'm not quite sure how one follows from the other. It certainly doesn't follow in any way trivially. Because, again, on the face of it, if there is stochasticity in quantum physics, and there is stochasticity in quantum physics, so that's uncontroversial, but if this stochasticity does remain, it's kind of a feature of the universe itself, then it seems like the bits of the universe that aren't determined are random. And randomness also, in my opinion at least, doesn't quite amount to libertarian free will. Libertarian free will is this idea of free will such that the entire physical universe could have been the same up to this point, and yet I could still choose to do otherwise than I am actually doing. That's different from something like compatibilist free will. I'm a real compatibilist, so, you know, in some ways I have very little horse in this debate. But anyway, given this randomness in the universe, I still don't think that really amounts to free will, because let's think about it. Say I wasn't determined in any of my choices, but instead of those choices being determined, they were literally random. So, you know, I don't know. There's no way of predicting what I'm going to do. At any moment, my will could flail out in a million different directions. It's just the result of a random number generator. I don't really think that's what libertarians mean when they talk about free will either. When I read, and admittedly, I've not read an awful lot of literature on this, so, you know, do take my opinions with a massive helping of salt here. When I read libertarian free will enthusiasts or proponents discuss free will, what they tend to want is something like, my will is an uncaused cause, if that makes sense. I just can make decisions and I can arbitrate between reasons, but the thing that is ultimately determining the choice isn't anything leading up to me. It's just me choosing. I can't make that picture make sense in my head. I really struggle with it. My favorite argument against libertarian free will isn't to do with determinism at all. It's actually to do with the idea that there might be inherent tensions within the concept of libertarian free will itself, which I think it's just a more fun way of approaching it. I don't see many people do that, and I think it's very interesting. But anyway, I think if you're going to have quantum physics be the plank on which you place your libertarian free will, then A, I think that your conception of libertarian free will needs to be refined enough that it doesn't just fall into quantum randomness. And B, we're going to have some argument about how the microstructures of randomness in quantum mechanics then somehow filters up into the macrostructures of my brain and body and the decisions I'm making at the world of medium-sized objects. Nonetheless, I do think that quantum indeterminacy does, in some sense, undermine the full determinist thesis that originally this free will undermining thesis was just an outgrowth of. So I think that's interesting in and of itself. But moving on. But before we move on, I want to take a brief moment to thank today's sponsor, Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning platform with classes on various different topics. You can find ones on touch typing or magic tricks or even interior design. I use their classes on Notion to get much more organized with my notes, which has helped me save hours of time and just make my workflow much more efficient. If you want a class to start out, then you should check out Tom Tamashiro's one on the Japanese philosophy of ikigai, or meaningful living. I know many of you are very interested in Eastern philosophy, and this would be a great place to explore that interest further. Skillshare is a long-term sponsor of this channel because I've really enjoyed learning new skills from them. I feel like I'm slowly accumulating all of these little hobbies and little interests that just make life seem that bit richer. The first 500 people to use my link will get a 7-day free trial of Skillshare and receive 20% off their first year of Skillshare. Plus, there is a 30-day money-back guarantee. So give the link a click to try it out. But anyway, back to the video. Okay, we've got a meme by Used Detective 2661, and it's the Scooby-Doo Fred man unmasking a villain. And at the top, it reads self-proclaimed nihilists, and then they're unmasked, and it's just a hedonistic lifestyle. So one thing this meme touches upon, which I think is really helpful if you're going to have really any kind of discussion around nihilism, is that the word nihilism or nihilist or what have you is incredibly polysemous. I kind of rediscovered that word watching the Jordan Peterson Jubilee debate. Now I absolutely love it because it's incredibly useful. So many of the terms in philosophy that we kind of use offhandedly actually do have a surprising number of meanings in literature, and even more so in kind of popular discourse. And nihilism is absolutely one of these terms. So this person's touched upon the fact that a lot of people that will call themselves nihilists are probably closer to something like short-term hedonists. I talked about this in my video about nihilism. I think that when we talk about nihilism, it's probably more helpful to talk about nihilism regarding certain things. So you might call a moral nihilist someone who doesn't believe in moral truths, but also I would say in this context, it would go slightly beyond that. It would be someone who doesn't think that morality matters in some sense. They don't use it as a principle for action or a guide for how they live their life. And sure, there are people like that, right? And if we run this definition forward, we could say that a total nihilist would be someone who thinks that literally nothing matters. And the trouble with this sort of thing is that basically no one in practice thinks that nothing matters, right? We all, if we are able to act at all, we are at least implicitly valuing some things and devaluing others. That's a point that Jordan Peterson makes a lot. Naturally, I don't have any trouble with that as an argument. I just think that it's kind of trivial, right? I'm not saying anything particularly deep or noteworthy. I'm just saying that in practice, most of us have some kind of means of organizing our actions. And this tends to mean that the term nihilist, referring to somebody who literally doesn't in practice think that anything matters, doesn't really find any purchase. It doesn't find anyone to refer to. So it kind of goes to the next step down, which is someone who thinks that nothing matters beyond their own pleasure. And to be fair, I don't think this is an insensible way to talk about nihilism at all. I think in Nietzsche, the two sometimes really go hand in hand. To a certain extent, you find this in his notes. He uses this image of the hedonistic Parisian youths as kind of either a precursor to nihilism or nihilists themselves. I can't quite remember the exact passage. But in his figure of the last man, in Thus Spake Zarathustra, you really do find a character who just only is living for pleasure. And more than that, a very short-term idea of pleasure. Because Epicureans, right, are hedonists, but they're not what springs to mind when you think of a hedonist. An Epicurean is, you know, perhaps unsurprisingly, somebody that follows the philosophy of Epicurus. But Epicurus himself, though he thought that pleasure was the only thing worth striving for. He thought it was the summum bonum, so to speak. He also didn't think that the way to achieve the most pleasure was going to be to, you know, go on debauched rampages and not care about anyone and only think about yourself, etc., etc., etc. Epicurus had a pretty nuanced and, I would say, quite insightful way of thinking about our human needs, among which he included things like food and water, unsurprisingly, and good company. You know, there was a real hallmark of Epicureanism is an emphasis placed on friendship and simple living. So although in a certain way Epicurus is definitely a hedonist, he's certainly not what we tend to refer to as a hedonist in the modern sense of the term, just because it's become very diluted, or not actually diluted, it's become very specified. It's now no longer someone who just thinks that pleasure is the summum bonum in a philosophical sense. It's someone who only lives for pleasure, and even within that kind of set of pleasurable things, only lives for the very short-term pleasurable things. And I think that when somebody uses the term nihilist, often that does mean this short-term hedonistic person, because if you don't value anything in the abstract, or you try and value as few things as possible, you are, to a certain extent, I think, left with just what your body can't help but value. If you were to try and strip away as much of your value system as possible, plausibly, the last line of defense just would be, right, I'm doing this because it feels good. That's a really natural sort of motivation. It's a, to a certain extent, it's a motivation about which we don't ask any further questions. If you ask somebody why they did something and they said, well, it felt good, then to a certain extent, you've reached bedrock. It's very hard to continue questioning them about that. So I think that one of the reasons why nihilist has come to mean this very particular subset of hedonists is just because in practice, there aren't many total passive nihilists who truly cannot do anything. I think that, you know, there might be some, but I think that most of them are sort of just people that are severely depressed, as opposed to it being a kind of philosophical position. I suppose the classic example of the nihilist who just is a short-term hedonist, or a short-term egoistic hedonist, I should say, would be someone like the Marquis de Sade. I plan to do a video on the Marquis de Sade at some point, because he is like a horrifying yet fascinating thinker. His philosophy is really difficult to put into words, because in some ways it is just an inversion of all of the philosophies of his day. So he has this book, Justine, which I cannot in good conscience recommend to anyone, because it's honestly horrible to read. Sade is this kind of, I don't know, he's somewhere between literature and obscenity. And full disclosure, I think that's definitely what he's going for. So I imagine that my slightly prissy, shocked, pearl-clutching response, probably Sade would look at me and say, well, yeah, of course you think that, Joe. You're a bit of a wimp. And maybe he's right, but I did find it quite difficult to read. But again, I think I've mentioned on the channel before, I just find violence quite difficult to read. I'm just a bit squeamish. Sade's whole philosophy is, in effect, he kind of rebels against God and the state of the universe, and sort of basically goes, right, the French Revolution, it's not gone far enough. It's abolished these, or not abolished, but it's fought against these notions of God and the king, which he thinks are also kind of superstitions. But it's not gone far enough. It needs to abolish this last superstition, which he thinks is morality. And unlike someone like Nietzsche or even Stirner, who tears down moral systems and then gives a rough idea of what he thinks might want to replace them, Sade's vision for what he wants to replace morality with is utterly horrible. It's sort of like the ethic of, right, take pleasure in everything, but also, more importantly for Sade, because he's a real transgressive, take pleasure in hurting other people. Sade is... His works display a kind of level of sadism, but also an intense level of masochism. Sade clearly derives some kind of pleasure from imagining himself being kind of hurt, as well as imagining himself hurting other people. And I do think that when people picture a nihilist, they do sometimes picture this Sadean figure. And I don't think that's totally unjustified, but I do think that there's more to nihilism than that. If I was just to talk about the different meanings of nihilism off the top of my head, there's kind of the Russian nihilist, right? Which does encompass some people who were, you know, rational egoists, but they weren't Sadean egoists. They thought that if everyone rationally followed their own egoistic desires, we would eventually be able to construct a kind of political utopia. I think Chernyshevsky, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, which I almost certainly am not, was kind of that school. And then Russian nihilism also just encompassed a whole disparate sect of kind of political radicals or just social reformers, right? You know, you got to remember, 19th century Russia's not a nice place to live. People understandably want some change. And nihilism as a label came to encompass everyone from people who wanted a kind of total collapse of the state to people who just kind of wanted mild social reform. So that's just one example of how nihilist is used in kind of a way that we now probably wouldn't recognize at all. So I think that this meme gets onto something perhaps slightly deeper than it intended, in that it's not just that sometimes when we say nihilist, we mean short-term hedonist. Sometimes when people say nihilist, they mean things that are totally unrecognizable to us today. And this is something that's really worth bearing in mind when we read the history of philosophy or read thinkers from the 19th century onwards, because otherwise you might end up very, very confused as to why somebody campaigning for incredibly radical social reform is being called a nihilist when that's nothing like the picture of a nihilist we have today. If somebody wants to fundamentally change the social and political makeup of their country, they probably care about quite a lot. But anyway, moving on. Next, we have a meme by Jacob1137, and it's a wolf taking off their sheep's clothing, and it reads, "How it feels to say some would argue when I'm the sum who would argue." I think almost every philosopher and every philosophy student has done this at some point. I've done it. I've done it in videos. Occasionally, you'll have a point, and it's a point that you do feel strongly about, but at the same time, you're not that sure that it's a good point. And so, rather than owning up to it, which may be the more honest thing to do, you sort of say, well, you could argue this, or some would argue this, or even some have argued this, if you can find another thinker that's argued something along the same lines. And I think this can be a kind of useful way to play with ideas, especially because, you know, every time we give an argument, we're not 100% sure that that argument is sound and valid, or even that it's at all cogent. And occasionally, just that little bit of distance can make you feel confident enough to put it in there, even though you're pretty sure there's probably quite a big flaw in it and you just haven't found it yet. There are quite a lot of examples of this sort of thing, right? You might come up with a relatively original position, but as a result, you're quite suspicious of it. I think that quite a lot of the time, if you see a philosophical problem and it immediately seems like it's soluble, and not only soluble, but it can be solved in a way that is so immediately obvious to you, there's normally just a big flaw in that solution. And again, sometimes that gives you a certain level of epistemic humility when giving it, and as a result, it can be useful to couch this in some would argue, or you may say, because you don't want to quite say, you're not confident enough to quite say, but you might say, perhaps even you would say, if you have more time to look into it. But for now, it's just that some would say. Next, we have a meme by different row 3353, and it's, oops, you added too much, and then it's got the various different cookies, butter, flour, egg, sugar, baking soda, and then finally, we've got predicate logic. And then we've got a sentence that reads, if there exists an x such that fx, then for any y, gy or not gy. Fair enough. It's kind of a weird sentence in that the second part is obviously sort of trivially true, at least in classical logic. Okay, well, whatever, man. I don't have much to say about this meme, but I just wanted to ask, so if we zoom in on the notation here, it's really weird. So most predicate logic, you put the predicate first and then the object. So this would normally be fx and it would be gy or not gy. But it's backwards here. And I have literally been sat here for the past 15 minutes searching for where this notation comes from. I initially thought it might be a Russell and Whitehead's Principia notation, because that's kind of, that looks very intimidating, so people often use it. But it's not that, because it doesn't have the dots that they use, which is what makes it so intimidating. And it also, instead of using the arrow, it still uses this curly implication symbol, which a lot of people don't use now because it looks too much like the subset hood symbol from set theory. And so it can get very confusing if you're playing around with this and subset hood. It just looks too similar, right? Like it makes it all very difficult. So anyway, this is less of a reaction and more of a cry for help, Does anyone know what type of predicate logic this is? What kind of notation it was? I thought it might be reverse Polish notation because I'd heard of that. And I thought, well, reverse, this is predicates after the object. That's pretty reversed. But no, because that doesn't have any brackets. Maybe this is just a huge gap in my logic knowledge. But if you have studied logic, please let me know where this notation may come from. If you're currently studying logic, is this the logic that's in your logic courses? Anyway, as I say, I don't have much insightful to add here. Please do let me know. Next, we have a meme by PointFirm6919, and it reads, "All art is political, MFs, when a five-year-old draws the sun wearing sunglasses. This is clearly an expression of deeply held beliefs and not a meaningless action done for simple pleasure." So I find the expression "all art is political" or just "everything is political" as really interesting, because I think that there's definitely something to it, right? We unavoidably live in a political context and a social context, right? And as a result, everything that we do is going to tell you something about our socio-political context and our economic context, right? So, for example, I wear this quarter zip because I rather naively think that it's quite fashionable. That perception that this is fashionable or that I think it in some way looks presentable does have a political and a social and to a certain extent an economic element to it. That's the sense in which I suppose you can draw certain political or social inferences from almost everything that humans do because we're social animals, right? We're influenced by our social and political and economic circumstances. However, I do think that this meme touches upon something, which is that not all art is equally political. There are explicit political manifestos and there is explicitly political literature, something like George Orwell's 1984, right? That is a work with a very clear political message. That doesn't mean that there aren't political dimensions to almost every piece of literature out there. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean that they have as much political content to them as an explicitly political work. The reason that I picked this meme is because I think this is a good illustrative example of a general principle that I think is useful when studying a lot of philosophical concepts, is gradability. So we can accept that all art, and indeed, I would say far more than all art, almost every human action will have a minimal amount of political influence to it. It will have some, right? Just because, to use the famous line, we live in a society. However, that doesn't mean that all art and all human behavior is the same level of political. You can do this with almost anything, right? All human behavior is expressive, but some human behavior is more expressive than others. All human behavior is emotional in the sense that it is driven by emotions because emotions are the motivating part of our psyche. But that doesn't mean that it is equally emotional when I sit down and write something in my notebook as when someone screams at the top of their lungs because they've just seen their loved one go through something horrible or they've just had something horrible happen to them themselves. They are both emotional experiences because all human experience is going to be tinged with an emotional element. But that doesn't mean that everything is equally emotional. I think this is a good point to make when these broad sweeping statements come up like everything is political, all art is political. It's like, yes, there is definitely something in this. However, we can't infer from that that everything is equally political or all art is equally political. So yes, I think this meme is right in a sense. I don't think that every artwork is inherently indicative of the artist's deeply held political beliefs, but I also don't think that is what most people mean when they say all art is political. I think they're more likely talking in this broader sense that the implicit assumptions within the artwork about what might be worth doing or what materials they're using or how they've decided to construct it and stuff like that, you can infer stuff maybe about that person's political context, not their political views, but their political context from that. A really, you know, trivial example of this, right, might be that if you find a very, very elaborate cave painting, the Sistine Chapel of cave paintings, what could you infer from that? Well, you could probably infer that whoever this group of people were that lived in that cave, they probably had a fair amount of free time and enough of a surplus of resources to be able to devote a considerable amount of effort to the construction of this elaborate cave painting. So that's not saying this cave painting is indicative of those cave people's political views. It's just saying you can infer something about the socio-political context of those artists from this piece of artwork. However, I'm sure that, like a lot of phrases, this is probably misused. And I do think that this notion of gradability might be helpful. all art will have some political content in it in this quite minimal way, but clearly some art is more political than other art. Okay, next we have a meme by Resicchio, and it's Lisa Simpson on the stage doing a presentation, and it reads, "Replace a wooden barrel with his mum's basement and Diogenes was just an ancient 4chan user." I got a lot of comments on my video about Diogenes that were words to this effect. It's like, if this guy was around today, we probably wouldn't call him a genius philosopher. We would probably call him a pain in the ass and possibly a bit mad. When we're reading stories of Diogenes, it is very easy to get this impression. I think that one of the unfortunate consequences, I suppose, of Diogenes's popularity through these legends and probably quite apocryphal stories is that these stories, because they're so entertaining, have become much more famous than Diogenes's philosophy, which is cynicism. He is Diogenes the cynic. Cynicism is a fascinating ancient school of philosophy. It's actually the school of philosophy out of which Stoicism grew. So if you're at all into Stoicism, you might actually find quite a lot to love about cynicism. Cynicism essentially held that very, very broadly, nature and living in accordance with nature was a very good thing. It was the route to human fulfillment and also was capital G good. It was actually virtuous in a very thick and concrete sense. And you can immediately see some coherence with Stoicism here. Stoics also believed in a universal logos and believed that acting in accordance with that logos was a good thing, both in the capital G good sense and also in bringing human fulfillment. Diogenes's philosophy did involve a lot more than merely living in a barrel and spitting on people and being generally kind of unpleasant to be around. Diogenes was also a really big fan of freedom. He wanted to preserve his own agency at all costs. And as a result, he wanted to need as few things as possible. So one of the reasons why he does live in a barrel and he does spurn possessions and he is a mendicant is because he hates the idea of comfort and of relying on things in order to have happiness. Again, we can see some connection with Stoicism here. When Epictetus talks about a rich person being a slave to their possessions, he's drawing on this original cynical idea all the way back there in Diogenes, which I think it's fascinating. So a lot of the time, what we remember Diogenes for are these absurd stories and these witticisms and these, you know, mean things he says to Alexander the Great and his phrase that in a rich man's house, the only place to spit is in his face and stuff like that. These kind of really catchy philosophical sound bites. But a lot of Diogenes' influence in the history of philosophy comes in through Stoicism and through this attitude of spurning possessions, living this more ascetic lifestyle in order to preserve freedom and limit your attachments to other things. That's an idea that I don't think has fallen out of favor at all, at least in, I don't know what to call them. I don't want to call them like wellness philosophies. That sounds absolutely awful. But these more practically minded philosophies that come from the ancient world and are still around today, they often maintain these capital C cynical themes. So yes, there is an awful lot to Diogenes' philosophy, and I think that may be what separates him from someone today living in their mum's basement. I don't know, a basement's like a really big thing in the US, because I've always grown up with this like meme, I suppose, in my head of the quote-unquote loser living in their mum's basement. Though, to be honest, with house prices as they are, I would be hesitant to condemn that person quite so much. But in any case, in the UK, it's relatively rare for a house to have a kind of expanded basement, or at least in the south of the UK, which is where I'm from. So this is my question to the Americans in the audience. I assume this is a cultural touchstone that has emerged from America. Do you all have basements? Because I love a basement. I have lived in one place with a basement, and the basement was awesome. And I had a chair in there, and I used to sit there and read in the basement. It was really cool. And also in summer, it was very chilled. It was a lovely place to hang out because you were just out of the heat of the sun, and because it was all kind of earth, I suppose, you kind of got the coolness of the earth around you. So I kind of wish the UK had more basements. But anyway, this discussion has drifted quite far off from Diogenes. But I think that is what separates Diogenes today from the loser archetype that we have in our cultural consciousness. Diogenes is doing all of these things for a principled reason that has sort of withstood the test of time and is alive and well in our ascetic traditions today. Whereas I would wager that the archetypal loser living in their mum's basement probably doesn't have that same kind of philosophical backing behind it. But then again, I suppose that depends on where do you think having a philosophical backing matters. I hope you do, because you're watching my channel, but you never know. Next, we have a meme by @you19, and it's that man sitting at the desk saying, "Meaning is a myth invented by existentialists to sell more philosophy. Change my mind." I kind of like this meme. I also think that it does touch upon something quite insightful, which is that phrasing existential questions like, what is the meaning of life, often aren't that helpful. I really like questions of existential meaning as either phrased in terms of affect, so how people feel, or phrased in terms of behavior, so how people act or what they're motivated to do. So I think that one of the best ways of thinking about nihilism is what you take as a rational motivation for something. And then one of the best ways to think about more practical nihilism is what you are in fact motivated by. And I think that once we're in that world of affect and motivation and action, it just brings the whole conversation a bit more down to earth. I think that posing questions like, what is the meaning of life? I think that people understandably go like, come on, Matt, like, what's the point of asking something like that? Whereas if we're phrasing it instead as, what will allow you to deal with suffering? Or what is it that gets you up in the morning? What motivates you? What makes you feel like life is enchanted and full and rich and emotional in the broad sense of the word? I think that A, communicates why these questions might matter and why existential philosophy might be helpful to them. And B, brings the conversation down to the specific topics that existential philosophers do tend to talk about. When Nietzsche talks about the last man, he's talking about action and motivation. When Dostoevsky talks about the underground man, he's also talking about affect, how the underground man feels, and motivation, action, what the underground man does, and how that's connects to his wider value system. It's not that we can't eventually bring in terms like meaning and value and these more abstract ideas, because I do think it's all connected. But I think that when we're just asking questions, I think that posing those questions at the level of affect and behavior when it comes to existential philosophy is going to be a more helpful way of framing it. Because as this meme almost alludes to, when we talk about meaning, it can become very unclear what that means. When I ask what I mean by meaning or what it would take for my life to be meaningful, I do tend to think there is an emotional component, life feeling full, and a motivational component, having reasons to do things. And so that's why I tend to cast them out in those terms. And I also think that those are the battlegrounds on which existential philosophers are often fighting. And I think that how this connects with values and how it connects with these more abstract ideas is a huge part of learning about existential philosophy. Rather predictably, someone in the comments has actually put this much better than me. They've said, yeah, what's the meaning of life is a horribly malformed question. Meaning, as a narrow semantic concept, isn't being referred to. Instead, it's more an ethical question. What should I do with my life? Captures it much better. Yeah, I maybe wouldn't use the term ethical just because I think that people hear that and think moral. But I get what this person's talking about. It's about being in the world and doing life and how we're meant to go about that. And specifically, how we might go about that in a sort of post-religious framework, potentially. I also think that trying to bring these existential questions more down to earth can prevent some confusion over terminology. We talked earlier about how the term nihilism has been used in many, many different ways, but meaning and value have also been used in many, many different ways. And connecting it more closely to feeling and behavior can just give everyone in the conversation a sense of what these terms are referring to, at least in the context of this discussion, which is always, it's always a bit of a danger when we're talking about existential philosophy or just any philosophy that is getting very abstract, yet is also to do with being in the world in some way. Ethics has this as well, which is that if you're not careful, all of those abstract terms that we've got to and have hopefully defined quite nicely, those definitions can get lost, and then they eventually pick out very different behaviors in the world for all of the different people in the conversation. And yeah, so I think that occasionally checking back in with that earthbound level can be very helpful for having productive discussions about existential philosophy, but also ethical philosophy and any kind of philosophy that's eventually going to cash out in this realm of action and observation and affect. Though, I should say, if meaning were a myth invented by existential philosophers to sell more philosophy books, I'd hope that more of them were being sold. Okay, those are all the memes that I have today. If you want to check out any of my previous meme videos, you can find them here. Thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.